One thing about it is I never know what y'all are going to say. Which is fine.
We don't know what you're
going to
say.
No, that's true. In fact, I got a few things to say today that might shock some of you. Oh. All right. Yeah, where are we at? All right, Job 31, that's exactly right. Waldrop thought last week he was going to challenge me on this chapter. Well, he did. So, if you'll turn over to chapter 31, we'll get started. I'm not going to read the text up front. We'll be looking at it as we go. And I'd like to begin with a question. If you had the chance, just before you died, what would your last words about yourself be? Now, you might be thinking, well, I'd rather speak about someone else, or better still, I'd rather speak about God. But what would you say about yourself? Now, it's unlikely that many of us, if any, will have the time, the clarity of mind, or the strength to speak the last words of our choice. But just supposing that you could, what would you like to say about yourself? What would be the most important final statement you would like to make about yourself before you meet your maker? Or, let's put it another way, what would be your first word about yourself to your maker when you're standing before his judgment throne? What is the most important thing you would want to say to God as your judge about you as a person? What words will sum up what is most deeply on your mind and in your heart concerning yourself? That's a rather searching question, is it not? When Paul the Apostle says and speaks with such certainty that there will be a resurrection and a judgment, he says this: "So I always do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience, both before God and before men," over in Acts 24. So the final thing Paul wants to be able to say about himself before he dies, and the first thing he wants to be able to say to God at the judgment is, "My conscience is clear. I have no unconfessed, unforgiven sin on my mind or in my heart. Therefore, I can face my Maker with confidence." Is that something that you can say about yourself? Chew on that for a little bit. Now, Job 31 is the first and final part of Job's final speech. And at the end, we read this dramatic statement. The words of Job are ended. And ended they are, apart from a couple of very brief explanations after God speaks. Chapter 31 is the final thing Job wishes to say about himself as he prepares to meet God. Now, we need to consider his words very carefully to see what exactly Job is claiming about himself and what the implications are for us as Christ followers. Now, it's easy, because I know because I've done it, it's easy just to skip over this chapter and get the impression that Job is just a self-righteous Pharisee thanking God that he is not sinful like other people. On the face of it, Job essentially says in chapter 31, and at some length I might add, "If I had done anything wrong, then I would have deserved to be punished by God. But I have not done anything wrong, so therefore God ought to vindicate me. Again and again, the structure in this chapter seems to be along the lines of, if I had done this particular sin, it would have been wrong and I would have deserved punishment, but I haven't. So we almost instinctively want to dismiss this speech as triteness or hypocrisy. If it were as simple as that, it would be hard to make sense of God's affirmation that Job at the end of this book in chapter 42. It would also be hard to make sense of God's rejection of Job's three friends also in chapter 42. His three friends who have said that Job is a hypocritical, self-righteous sinner who refuses to admit his guilt. No, says God, he is not. He is not. So then, if that's the case, what exactly is Job saying? In chapters 29 and 30, Job has spoken about his experience and has reflected on what these experiences seem to mean for his standing before God. Now he speaks about himself, his character, his actions, his desires, and his heart. So with that in mind, let's begin examining this chapter. And Job begins this chapter by saying in verse 1, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? And what is the portion of God from above, or the heritage of the Almighty from on high? Is it not calamity to the unjust and disaster to those who work iniquity? Does he not see my ways and number all my steps? Remember now, these are the last words of Job's last speech in his own defense, and he begins by saying in verse 1 that he has entered into a covenant. Okay, so he's entered into a covenant. But who with? Well, with himself. More specifically, with his own eyes. However, Bullinger says that the Hebrew does not literally say that Job made a covenant with his eyes. The covenant here was made with God against his eyes, which are regarded as an enemy most likely to lead him astray. Specifically, in the aspect of his desires, his affections, and the longings of his heart. Now, this is not a covenant given to him outside of himself like the covenant that God made with Abraham later on. No, it's a covenant with himself. And what it boils down to is this. Job has solemnly bound himself to keep a clear conscience. One other commentator put it this way. When Job says that he has made a covenant with his eyes to abstain from lust, he does not mean that he has stopped experiencing lust altogether. What he means is that he refuses to dwell upon the sinful or upon the lustful thoughts and feelings which, as the normal red-blooded male he is, come to him very naturally. The particular desire he speaks of is to gaze at a virgin. The word virgin means, in this context, an attractive and desirable young woman who is not his wife. To gaze means to eye up with a view to sex. Now, this goes beyond the recognition that she is attractive. There's no sin in thinking that a woman is attractive. And this recognition actually can be turned into thankfulness to God for making such beauty. Rather, this is to indulge in the creative fantasy of having sex with her, to allow desires to grow in his heart that, in the absence of any outward restraint, would lead to adultery or sexual immorality. This also suggests that the eyes are the gateway for lust, especially for we men. This is demonstrated over and over again, both by personal experience and firsthand study. When a man places enticing, sensual, lust-inducing images before his eyes, it is a form of foreplay, especially considering that it often or frequently causes some level of sexual arousal in men. There certainly existed some type of pornography in Job's day. In fact, some of the earliest artistic images of men and women and together in highly sexualized themes were common. Nevertheless, Job certainly didn't have to contend with the sophisticated, gigantic, and far-reaching modern pornographic industry of our day. The availability of modern pornography, especially on the internet, has made it a significantly greater challenge for men to confine their visual arousal to the allotment of God. Now, if you want to know what the allotment of God is, men, that's your wives. This is what Job has solemnly bound himself to do. In our day, however, are many biological, cultural, economic, social, and technological factors that make it much more difficult for a man to make a covenant with his eyes, to not look upon a young woman in the sense meant here by Job. It is more difficult for a man to choose satisfaction with what God has allotted him and to avoid the destruction and the disaster that Job spoke of. Nevertheless, by the power of the living God, by God's Spirit, it can be done. What does Philippians 4:13 tell us? I can do all things through Christ, who does what? Strengthens me. We can do it. We can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And obedience to God in this arena is a precious, wonderful sacrifice made unto our Lord, a genuine way to present our bodies a living sacrifice unto Him, not being conformed to this world. That's what Romans 12, verses 1 and 2 tells us. This verse points to self-control in the area of desire, as well as in the actual practice of what we see with our eyes. Pastor Ash points out that Job seems to highlight this particular desire. Why, he asked. Why would Job highlight this particular area of his life? Is he obsessed with sex or something, is the question being asked. And if you drop down to verse 9, and read through verse 12, Job includes adultery in his list of sin as well. So I would say, rather than it being an obsession, it's likely that he begins with this not because it's worse than the other sins that he will list, or because it's the supreme temptation in Job's life, but because in his heart-searching demands, it can symbolize and sum up a life of inner purity. I think every man in this room, every man in here can testify that the The calling to inward sexual faithfulness is a searching demand, especially in the day in which we live, where at every turn you will see sexually explicit images. To adapt the language of James 3:2, any man who can keep his sexual desires under full control is able to control his whole body. Not only that, but there is a strong connection in the Bible between sexual faithfulness and religious faithfulness. To be faithful in the area of sex is closely connected with the avoidance of idolatry. It would therefore be a mistake to take this as the first in Job's list of possible sins. Rather, it headlines his commitment to purity of the heart. And what he's doing is he is agreeing entirely with his three friends that impurity and wickedness in his heart would bring upon him calamity and disaster as his portion and heritage, as indicated by verses 2 and 3. The covenant Job has made, young men especially, I want you to hear this, the covenant he has made is to keep a clear conscience before God, his maker. Now, we don't know how much Job knows about God and God's standard, but he knows something. And he has pledged himself to keep his conscience clear. The implied answer to Job's question in verse 4 is a resounding yes. Yes, God sees all and would discipline him should he ever start to entertain and embrace lustful thoughts. But Job was innocent of such secret sin. In verses 5 and 6, Job proceeds to the area of his business dealings. He stated that, if I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened after deceit, then Job declared metaphorically, let him weigh me with accurate scales and let God know my integrity. Here's what he meant. Lord, if you would just judge me by your divine righteous standards, you will know that I am blameless. Poor old Job. He doesn't know that God already knows that he's blameless. He doesn't know that God already knows that he's a man of integrity. In verses 7 and 8, Job uses what's called an oath of clearance in the form of a negative confession. It's a procedure that was well known in ancient jurisprudence. A crime could be disavowed by calling down a curse upon oneself. And that's what Job's doing here. Job says that if his steps have turned from the path of right and fair dealings with others, and his heart has been led by his eyes, becoming greedy for what he saw, or his hand has been defiled, has defiled with wrongdoings. Verse 7, Job pronounced a curse of self-judgment. Such was Job's confidence in his innocence. May others eat what I have sown, Job declared. That is, may others reap and benefit from my labor at my expense. May my crops be uprooted, not for me to enjoy, if my business dealings were unprincipled, verse 8. And notice how the punishment fits the crime. Job was willing to be deprived of the fruit of his own labor if it was true that he was found lacking on the honest scales of God's judgment. Chambers noted the confidence that Job had in calling curses upon himself if he were not truthful is impressive. It's as if he said to his friends, do you think that I'm trying to make out before God that I am what I have not been? Would I talk to God with what has been blatant insolence if I had not the facts to back me up. And then in these next four verses, Job declares that his heart is free of any unfaithfulness or adultery. Here again, in verses 9 through 12, he uses an oath of clearance. If I have cheated on my wife, or if I have lusted for my neighbor's wife, then let my wife serve another man. Let other men sleep with her. If I am an adulterer, then let me suffer the consequences. In pronouncing the penalty that he should pay, had he done such a thing, Job says, may my wife grind for another and let others kneel down over her. That is, may she serve another man as his wife and may other men sleep with her, because she would then be released from Job because of his unfaithful actions. Such a sin of marital infidelity would have been shameful before the eyes of God and the world. It would be a sin that God would surely judge. Now listen, sexual sin has built-in consequences which are designed by God. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry. But when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. Do you hear me? Do you hear what he says? The psalmist says he lacks sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give him many gifts. I tell you what, it's hard to satisfy an angry, jealous man. Thus, the judgment of God is a fire that burns to destruction. And this is a reference to Abaddon or death and the grave. And you see that over in Proverbs 5 and 7. This fire that the psalmist is talking about will consume a man's soul. It will destroy his marriage and his reputation, all his hard work. And all that's pictured by Job's words, by the phrase, my harvest. I can tell you this, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. I can't tell you the number of pastors I've seen destroy their lives because they went after another man's wife. You ask Teddy back there. He's seen the same thing. We've seen good preachers destroy their lives and their families because of their infidelity. It's not worth it. Next, Job affirms in verses 13 through 15 that his dealings with others is marked by justice. In his statement, if I have despised the claims of my male or female slaves, in verse 13, what he's doing is shifting the focus of his self-examination to his dealings with others and inviting investigation and inquiry into his dealings with them. In other words, if I have wronged them in any way, what then could I do when God arises and confronts me? How will I ever be able to answer him? Verse 14. And one reason Job treated his servants so well was because he understood that he would have to answer to God for his actions towards others, including his servants. He understood that God cared about his servants and would avenge any mistreatment of them. We know from chapter 1 that Job had a large number of servants and he confessed that they had certain rights. And these rights were based, he said, on the creation of all people by God. What would Job say when called to account by God? Truth is, no excuse could be offered, Job said, if he had mistreated any person, no matter how lowly the status they occupied. And recognizing that God is impartial, Romans 2:11, Job stated, "Did not he who made me in the womb make him, and the same one fashion us in the womb?" Of course, the answer to Job's question is, all men are created with dignity and equality by God and are therefore deserving of fair and impartial treatment. Earlier in chapter 22, Eliphaz, in trying to figure out what sin Job was guilty of, charged Job with abusing the poor and the helpless. You remember that? Here, Job, he once again refutes that charge, as he's already done in previous chapters, chapters 24 and 29. What he does, he lists a litany of possible offenses, all of which began with the word if, denoting uncertainty. If I have denied the desires of the poor or widows, then Job believed that he deserved to suffer as he was. And then in verses 17 and 18, if I have kept my bread to myself, hoarding it selfishly, Job declared, not sharing it with the fatherless or the orphans, then he had suffered justly. Yet Job's life and deeds had demonstrated just the opposite. To the contrary, Job reared the orphan as he would his own son, showing fatherly kindness and compassion to those in need. And it says, from infancy, I guided the widow. Job said in verse 18, he had shown her loving attention that was validated by his deeds of love. Job's life was exemplary of deeds done to promote the good of those who could not help themselves. Job was a good man. He was a good man. Or if anyone was lacking clothing, look at verse 19. If anyone's lacking clothing and he did not help, Job says, well, then he was deserving of severe punishment by God. Job's love for others was not demonstrated in word only, but by his benevolent deeds. If the heart of the needy did not bless me, Job said, by giving him fleece to warm him, verse 20, then he should be rebuked and punished by God. But to Job's knowledge, he had not committed any such sins against the helpless. If I have raised my hand to do harm to the fatherless or to the orphan, verse 21, Job said he should suffer. But he maintained that he had not done so. Nor had he misused his influence in court to throw out a case and escape justice. If guilty of these things, all these things that he's mentioned here, then he deserves the suffering that he has been enduring. If guilty, Job pronounced this curse upon himself. And here's what he says. Let my arm fall off from the shoulder. Or he also asserted that his arm should be broken off at the joint if he is guilty. Now that's a pretty terrible thing. Reminds me of that movie about Braveheart, how they tore him from limb to limb. In other words, that's what Job says he deserves if he's mistreated the widow or the orphan. Job had lived with great restraint and fear of mistreating others because he dreaded destruction from God. Now, saints, fear of punishment is a strong deterrent to sin. fear of God prevented him from doing such things. He was a charitable man. He gave freely of all that God had blessed him with. Discerning or disclaiming any false trust in idols or any misaligned spiritual priorities, Job claimed in verse 24, "If I have put my confidence in gold rather than God for security, then I deserve what I get. Then certain negative consequences should follow." Then certain, earlier in chapter 24, Eliphaz had encouraged Job to let go of his gold and let God become his gold and his greatest treasure. Well, Job had never clung to his gold. He had always clung to God. "If I have rejoiced over my great wealth rather than having delighted in God," Job said, "then he should suffer for it." But he had never placed his wealth before the Lord. Rather, he was modest and benevolent. "If I have regarded the sun and moon in worshiping the creation rather than the Creator," glorifying those things rather than God, Job declared that he would be an idolater, deserving of punishment. So, he says in verse 27, "If such idolatry has caused my heart to be secretly enticed, offering a kiss of homage, then I should suffer." Boy, there's a lot of ifs here, isn't there? If I've done this, if I've done that, then I deserve it. But Job had never bowed his knee to a single foreign idol. He had never mistreated a widow or an orphan. He had never mistreated his servants. It's wrong. Then if such wrong priorities were in place, they were sins to be judged by God. Otherwise, he would be unfaithful to God. Job had been entrusted with great riches. We saw that when we were in chapter 1, but he had not succumbed to the temptation of greed and worldliness. Instead, he kept his faith in God first and foremost in his life and thus invited further blessings from God. Next, Job cleared himself of any sin of gloating over the misfortune of his enemies. He says, "If I have rejoiced at my enemy's misfortune or gloated over the trouble that came to him, then I would most certainly deserve God's discipline." But he hadn't done that. Further, in regard to his enemies, Job asserted, "I have not allowed my mouth to sin by invoking a curse against his life," verse 30. Job had not verbally condemned others by calling down judgment on them. And neither had he withheld feeding meat to any stranger who was in need. His servants, the men that worked for him, who served him, who lived in his household, would verify this as a fact in verse 31. His door was always open to the traveler. No stranger was ever turned away by him. No stranger ever had to spend the night out in the street. And Job defended his hospitality towards foreigners. Neither had hypocrisy or duplicity been an issue in Job's life. "If I have concealed my sin as men do, covering my guilt within my heart, then by implication Job would deserve the suffering that he was experiencing." But this was not the case. Nor had he attempted to hide his sin from the crowd or the clans. He had not remained behind closed doors in isolation, living a double life as one who would not go outside. Job did not hide like a hermit. He lived in open view before everyone because he had nothing to hide. In a final effort to have God answer him, Job longed for someone to hear him and verify his case before the Lord. "Oh, that I had someone to hear me." Look at verse 35. To authenticate his statement of innocence, he stated in a figurative tone, he says, I sign now my defense. Audaciously, he demanded, let the Almighty answer me. Whether by vindication or punishment, let him answer me. Let his accuser, his accuser who he thought was God, let him put his indictment in writing in order to present it to him. God, put it in writing and give it to me. I need some answers. Job desired to wear such charges on his shoulders for everyone to see. Then he'd be able to refute God's indictments against him and prove his innocence. That's what Job thought. In fact, he boasted that he would wear such charges like a crown on his head in verse 36. He would give God an account of his every step and then await God's verdict of acquittal. Job was pretty sure of himself, wasn't he? And there was no area in Job's life hidden from God's scrutinous eye. In fact, like a prince filled with great confidence, Job would approach God without hesitation. Then finally, Job returned to the one last area of his life that had not yet been addressed, the stewardship of his land. If my land cries out against me to God because of blood guilt, he said, then he should be punished by the Lord. If Job had devoured its yield without payment and paid his servants, then divine judgment would have consumed his harvest. Not to pay his worker their rightful wages was a grievous sin. And this would break the spirit of its tenants and invite God's curse on the land. If Job mistreated the land, he says, then let briars come up instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley, in verse 40. This is the divine judgment that Job says should occur if he were guilty. The words of Job are ended. The words of Job are ended. The three cycles of speeches between Job and his three friends that began in Job 4 are now completed. Job, who had the first word in Job 3, has had the last word in Job 31. So I think, looking at all the areas that Job touched on, we need to conduct a personal survey. And each of these areas that Job searched out in his own life. So I'm going to ask you some questions. What about your thought life? First thing he dealt with, you're the only person who can inventory this secret part of your life. Is it pure? Is your mind closed to illicit sights? Do you resist lustfully looking at other men or women? What about your ethics? Have you padded your expense account? Have you failed to report all your income to the IRS? Is your word your bond? What about your home life? Are you singular in your devotion to your spouse? What about your work life? Can you say that you treat your secretary fairly? Do you treat your employees with compassion? And would they say the same? Could those who work for you raise a complaint against you? How about those who you work for? How about them? What about your community life? Do you reach out to widows? Do you help the needy? Do you give to the poor? A real part of our Christian faith is how we treat those who are weak and destitute. What about your financial life? What is your attitude towards money? Do you hold your money with an open hand? Are you gripped with a passion to have more of it? Do you have your money, or does it have you? What about your spiritual life? What idols do you hold in priority above God? Are you spending adequate time in the Word of God and in prayer? Do you value the creation over the Creator? What about the stewardship of your gifts? What has God entrusted to your care? What spiritual gifts and ministry opportunities has God given you? What family responsibilities? What witnessing opportunities? Have you been a faithful steward of the things God has entrusted to you? Our personal faith must be so integrated into our lives. Now listen, it must be so integrated into our lives that every area is significantly affected. We do not compartmentalize our faith. It is a part of our lives. It influences every area of it. So, let me ask you all to bow your heads and think about the questions I've asked. And ask yourself these questions. And let's examine ourselves as Job has examined himself. Would you bow with me? God, I know that we all fall short in so many areas. I know I do. I know as I went over this list, Lord, that God, I'm guilty in so many ways. And I ask your forgiveness. God, I ask that you give me a heart for those in need, a heart for the widow, a heart for the orphan, a heart for those that I work with and work around with. Lord, allow me to take advantage of every opportunity to tell others the good news of the gospel. God, I pray that you will make us like Job, not afraid to examine our lives. Not be afraid of what you will reveal to us, Lord, as we ask you to search our hearts and our minds. And Lord, when we see something that needs to be changed, God, give us the desire and give us the gift of being able to repent. And Lord, act as if in a way that Christ acts. In Christ's name, amen.